Good evening, everybody.
Hello and welcome to Disney Magic Hour, episode 109. On this week's show, we are going into part 8 of our Great Movie Ride film series featuring the classic Casablanca. To my left, as always, is Melissa. Say hello, Melissa.
Hello, Melissa.
Joining me via Skype is Courtney Van Ren. Say hello, Courtney.
Hello, Courtney.
From the Main Street Gazette, as always, is Ryan Wilson. Say hello, Ryan.
Hello, Ryan.
And joining us as a special guest this week is the one and only Chelsea Lucas. Say hello, Chelsea.
Hello, Chelsea.
Hello, Pete. And say hello, Pogo. This episode of Disney Magic Hour is brought to you by MEI Travel. For all your vacation planning needs on visiting Walt Disney World, taking a cruise, or traveling anywhere around the globe where you may wait and wait and wait. Visit the experts over at MEITravel.com, where Becky and her team can get you started on your own adventure. Right now you're listening to There You Are. You can find this track and more over at SoundCloud.com/PogoMix. His website is PogoMix.net. We are LastGenPodcast.com. Find us on Twitter for this show at Diz Magic Hour Pod. That's D-I-S Magic Hour Pod. On Facebook, we have our Disney Magic Hour group. Add yourself if you're already there. Add your friends. You can find this show on iTunes, Google Play Music, and Stitcher. And Melissa, where can everyone find photographs?
On Instagram at Disney Magic Hour Podcast.
And what about if they want to support the show?
They can head over to patreon.com/DisneyMagicHour, and you can find how you can help support us and keep us going.
Yay! Support! Help! 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 SOS! Help! Ryan Wilson, where can everyone find you and the Main Street Gazette?
They can find the Main Street Gazette at mainstgazette.com. If you use the Main ST Gazette for Instagram or Twitter, you'll find us there. And we also have a Facebook page if you just search for Main Street Gazette.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How's everyone feeling?
Tired.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, it was a long week, huh? Yeah, it is now Sunday morning at 9 a.m. So I know Mr. Ryan Wilson is recovering currently from a bit of a hiccup.
Yeah, I had a flu bug, and then I was traveling for work. I caught another bug on the back end of that. And so somewhere in there, I'm just trying to get myself back on my feet.
You're like the monkey from Outbreak. You're going to ruin this whole world.
As long as it all goes away before I have to get on a boat and infect other people in 2 weeks, I'm all good.
Yeah, that's in 2 weeks, right?
Yeah, that's in 2 weeks.
Mm. Man, we got to talk about our scheduling. Forgot about that. Oh, no, we figured it out. That's right. We figured out our scheduling.
We got it. We have a schedule. We're in good shape.
Yay. Good morning, Courtney.
Hey, what's up?
Nothing. How's things in your part of wherever you live?
I live in Asheville, and things are good here. The colors are starting to change, and it's cooling off, so it's lovely.
That nothing you just said makes sense to me.
I know.
It
bless
sucks.
Your heart.
It is so disgusting here right now. The last 3 days have been horrible. It was like 2 in the morning. I had to go onto our little, what's this called? Deck, veranda, whatever you want to call it. I had to go out there to get something from the storage closet we have out there. And it was so gross. I was outside for like maybe 10 seconds. And I was like, oh, I'm sweating. It's so disgusting.
Yeah, that's not good.
Melissa, how are you?
I'm fine.
There you go, folks.
That's all I got. All right. I got a lot going on.
It's like the color commentator in Major League.
Yeah.
Of course, we are joined this week by a special guest as we talk about, one of the best films of all time, spoilers on this whole, like, does it work? Yeah, it does. Shut up. But we are joined very sweetly by Chelsea Lucas from the state of Philadelphia. City, state?
Yes, city of Philadelphia. It's a big move.
Yeah, yeah, officially out of the Big Apple and into whatever Philadelphia calls itself. I don't know. Exactly. What
the city of brotherly love.
Is that, oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Unless you're like a sports fan that isn't like from Philly and then they just want to throw stuff at you. But that's but you've been busy this week, huh?
I have been, yeah. Just between making the move, new job. things have been going really good. I'm excited. This is the next start in my acting career, and I couldn't be happier. It's just very long days. Very, very long days.
Yeah. At a later date, me and you are going to have a longer conversation about the specific thing you're doing right now, because yes. You know I'm aware of it, and it's a thing we have to discuss. Yes. So when we first started up this, you know, the film series on Great Movie Ride, there were some films that like me and you spoke about immediately. And the number one, like, I have to be there. I want to be on that one. It was Casablanca.
Yes, absolutely. That film has had a very special place in my heart, in my family's heart for many years, many generations for many different reasons. But as an artist myself and as an actor, it's a film that I've studied. It's a film that I've respected. And it really is one of my favorite films of all time. So I'm so excited and honored to be talking about it.
I would say that this film had the most excitement behind it. You know, when we do the threads and whatnot, I would say it was this one. I think Indy was still edged it out just because of the fan popularity of Indiana Jones and all that. But, like, you know, there were some of the older films where a lot of folks were a little trepidatious, like going into the thread. They're like, I don't know if this is going to be weird. And there wasn't that feeling on this one, Courtney. You know, it just seemed that the excitement level was there for as much as a much more modern film that people are comfortable with. Yet this one, you know, sits back in the 40s, but it kind of transcended it.
Yeah, you could really see the passion that a lot of people in the group had for this film right away. And in the thread, man, there were some people that really had some strong emotional connections to this one. And really, they were all about it.
Yeah, they were just on board 100%. Now, Melissa, you'd seen this before. Yeah, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. All right. That's it. That's all we're getting, guys. We're getting. She's ones and zeros today. It's just a good yes and no's. That's it.
I just obey. That's it.
And Ryan, I mean, this isn't a movie that was foreign to you previous to this, right?
No, it's in the top like three movies of all time for me. I love this movie, Inside Out, Forward, Backward. It's fantastic.
So I guess let's start talking about it, and then we'll get into the deeper of the story and whatnot. So Casablanca had its world premiere on November 26, 1942. It opened wide on January 23rd, 1943. The opening of the film was actually moved forward from late spring to kind of take advantage of the headlines after Allied forces landed in Axis-occupied Europe in November of 42. It actually opened, you know, the original premiere was Thanksgiving Day in New York City, and it followed up with a parade on Fifth Ave. It was called the Fifth Ave of Free French. The leaders were there, basically. And the Free French flag was flown out, and it was the first time that had happened in the U.S. since the fall of Vichy.
That's a lot of Fs.
Yeah, that was, you know what, that was... Yeah, that was a whole lot of things to go through. I actually had read that from TCM's website, and I thought that was kind of fascinating. So there was a lot of smart marketing done on the behalf of this film so it could take advantage of, you know, the patriotic flow. And it happens to this very day. You know, you'll see something happens, and then all of a sudden there's a movie coming out, and there's 50 American flags flying in the background. But, you know... It's just weird, you know. You will see that, and we're okay with it at the time. You know, we're totally okay with it at the time because we want that. You know, people want that feeling of, you know, pride and whatnot. So this film did the same thing. It's kind of cool. Like, it's kind of cool. It's also kind of crazy where you're like, those methods never changed because they work. It clocks in at 102 minutes and earned $3.7 million over at the box office on a budget. I had two numbers. I had a budget of like $875. I also had a budget of $975, which would have then put it over its budget because I guess its target was $875. Again, when we're talking about films back in the 40s, it's kind of, you know, word of mouth. You know, you try to find like an old article from the Hollywood Reporter or something like that. There's nothing like written down like, hey, this is how it happened. It isn't like now where you know the budget of the film as well as the producer, which is totally unnecessary. And also then makes people overtly critical of everything that happens because you know everything that happens. Yeah, there's a whole thing to be said about knowing too much because, like, I can just imagine if we followed, like, the production schedule of, like, Empire Strikes Back, and if anyone read, like, oh, there's going to be a thing in the snow? That's stupid. Isn't this space? Like, people would do that. It's crazy. Anyways, it's a whole nother conversation. Where were we? We were talking about how much it made and all that. It went on to be quite successful at the Oscars, though, which was not expected. This was not a film that was packaged as like, hey, guys, this is going to be the movie.
Yeah, exactly. And to that point, at the time, as everybody knows, but just to reiterate, you know, this was the peak of the golden era of Hollywood. You know, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, Sam Goldwyn, Louis Mayer, David O. Selznick, this was their time. And in the studio of Warner Brothers, they were pretty much hashing out a movie a week, maybe every other week. So they certainly did not think that this was going to be the movie that would go down in history as one of the greatest movies of all time, not by any means whatsoever.
And that's, I think that's, isn't that sort of how it happens though? Like it's the movies that aren't, you know, hey, we've got so much star power and it's going to be this big thing. Usually the movies with a lot of names and this and that, they don't gel. Like there's a weird thing that happens. Where it doesn't gel. Spotlight would be the most recent, admission to that rule. No, that's not the right word. Anyways, exception? You know what? Exception. Thank you. I said admission. That's not the right word. You know, that would be like a good recent exception to the rule where there was like all these people in it, but they were all kind of underplayed roles. Where even on this, you know, in Casablanca, when you look at it, yes, of course, like you know, there are a couple of like massive names. But the characters are all sort of in the same level, you know, in a sense, in a way. So I always feel that's a better way of doing it. But yeah, this was not expected to win Best Picture, Best Director, Best Adapted Screenplay, and even more so, it was nominated for Best Actor for Humphrey Bogart. Claude Rains was nominated for Best Supporting Actor. Arthur Edison was supported for cinematography. It was also nominated for Best Editing and Musical Score. So, garnered all this attention. It's garnered so much of a history over it, and it just really wasn't in the works originally. So, but it does not start there. It does start though with a screenplay. So, Mr. Ryan Wilson, where did Rick begin?
In New York. Actually, there was a pair of school teachers, Joan Allison and Murray Bennett, who had written this play effectively all around, you know, Rick and his story. And Warner, having not even read it, picked it up and said, we're going to run with this, which I imagine, you know, considering how fast they were putting out movies, that's common course. Like, yep, that sounds good. Let's go. But then you have Hal Wallace, who wants to get involved and wants to make sure this is done right. But they had turned the screenwriting duties over to Julius and Philip Epstein, known for movies like Strawberry Blonde and No Time for Comedy. But Wallace really wanted less comedy, more drama into this. And so he kept passing it on to more and more screenwriters like Howard Koch and Casey Robinson. You start adding in the fact that you have Bogart, who's claiming that most of, you know, a lot of his lines were ad-libbed and that he created those. And you get this kind of mishmash of, you know, we don't know who wrote what. There were rewrites going into the actual production time. Like, they didn't even have a full script set when they went to production. And that's where we get this story that we all love. But it comes from this really kind of chaotic screenwriting process.
That sounds about right. I mean, yeah, everything, it seemed like it was sort of, it was, you know, again, they did pay a lot though for the play. I want to say it was at a price tag of $20,000. If I remember correctly, it was bought off of that. Yes. At the time, that was a gigantic amount. So someone knew. Like, someone had an inkling, like, okay, yeah, this is a little better than the norm. And, you know, we have something here. But as usual, you know, usually when you can't see the forest from the trees and the people who were involved in the production itself, it's hard to see, like, oh, yeah, by the way, we're you don't know you're making a classic.
But it's funny, like, I just looked up real quick the other movies from 1942, and, like, the only other one that I recognize is Bambi.
Well, okay. Yeah.
I know it's me. Shush your face. But still.
Yeah, as far as, like, pop films and whatnot, I don't know. I have to look at a list of what came out in 42. But, actually, towards Howard Koch, as you were saying, or is it Koch? I keep seeing that. I see Ed Koch in my head, and I'm like, mayor of New York. there was a little bit of a history with him, you know, going forward, because in 43, he wound up writing Mission from Moscow, which I want to say was also directed by Michael Curtis. And it became a thing that was used against him in the House of Un-American Activities Committee. And he was actually blacklisted from Hollywood in 51. But what's interesting is that the director, who we're going to talk about in a moment, didn't get into that because he didn't write the script. It was like that distinct that, you know, who they would go after in that crazy time of Hollywood, that, you know, he just wasn't part of it and didn't have to deal with that. So let's speak about our director here, because, my God, the film is directed by Michael Curtis, whom has, to his credit right now, well, that's not going to get any larger, 178 directing credits, which includes Adventures of Robin Hood, White Christmas, Mildred Pierce, The Jazz Singer, Mission to Moscow, as I just sort of said, Yankee Doodle Dandy, and 20,000 Years in Sing Sing, and Angels and Dirty Faces, of course, all that with our friend James Cagney. And, of course, whenever I can bring up Captain Blood, I will, because Goonies. I mean, you know, if you're a kid of the 80s, you know Captain Blood from a couple of clips of film, and that's all you needed. That's really all you needed. Cinematography was done by Arthur Edison, as noted before. And again, the list of films on these people's resumes is just insane. Frankenstein, Maltese Falcon, All Quiet on the Western Front, Gold Diggers of 37, Mutiny on the Bounty, and Invisible Man, which, of course, starred Claude Rains as the title character. Melissa's upset with me because I said that aloud.
Yeah, stepping on my cast.
I assumed I was going to ask you about cast, and you would have said yes.
No.
Ah, see, there we go.
Switching it up.
So
you're going to be Captain Blood second, is what's going to happen.
Arthur Edison, over 130 films on his resume. And just as a side note, the technical advisor Robert Eisner, actually escaped a concentration camp by way of Casablanca. And do you want to talk about, there's someone else on the crew. I don't know if you want to talk about that. You want to talk about that? There's some other, like, crazy connections to people who actually escaped, you know, occupation at the time. But I think that kind of goes into the cast and crew a little bit. So, Melissa, who be speaking in this film? That's how we say things.
Is it how we say things? I don't know about that.
Who?
A majority of the cast actually all were escaping occupied Europe. And a couple did go through, you know, Spain and various other routes to get there. But yeah, a lot of them did that. However, not our main star, Mr. Rick. He's played by Humphrey Bogart. He had his breakout role in The Petrified Forest from 1936. He appeared in 28 films from 1936 to 1940. So in his first 4 years, he did 28 films. So what is that, 70 a year about? He was usually a gangster. He appeared in 2 westerns and even a horror film. So it wasn't until 1941 that he had his landmark year and kind of capitalized on whatever George Raft was rejecting, and kind of took off from there. I'll give a little bit of a list of his. We have Kid Galahad, The Maltese Falcon, The Big Sleep, High Sierra, Key Largo, The Keen Mutiny, Sabrina, The African Queen, which if I have to mention because it's my favorite attraction. This was the movie Harper Goth kind of used when designing Jungle Cruise. And of course...
could you imagine if there was like a Katharine Hepburn thing in Jungle Cruise? It's like shaking her fist at you and yelling at you as you went by.
Well, they're gonna so just great. Put the Bogart animatronic from Great Movie Ride in there now.
You know what? Yeah. Put him in the temple.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And
he's talking to a monkey, giving the same speech. It'd be great.
And another little movie called Passage to Marseille, which I thought was interesting because they definitely reference Marseille and Casablanca a lot, and there's a few other people in that movie.
They never mention it. I'm sorry.
Marseille?
I don't remember a single moment.
Yeah, they do when they're in Paris.
Nope. There were people crying on the thread when the Marseille scene was going on. The singing.
Oh.
All right? Okay.
No.
Move along.
Sorry. Let's go to our leading lady, Ilsa, played by Ingrid Bergman. Gorgeous. She was described by Roger Ebert in this movie. He said she paints his face with her eyes, and I could think of no better description than that because that's exactly what we talked about in the thread was her eyes, her emotions. Funny enough, other actresses were considered for this movie. Hedy Lamarr.
That's Hedley.
I was waiting for it.
Yes.
Louise Rainer, who you'll know from The Great Ziegfeld. And Michelle Morgan. She actually did star with Bogart in Passage to Marseille and a few other movies that we'll get to. And Anne Sheridan was also considered, and she was with Cagney and Angel with Dirty Faces. So we had a couple of other ladies, but they went with Bergman. Bergman started really in 1933, Intermezzo. That was her U.S. Debut. It was Intermezzo, a love story. It was reprising her role from a 1936 film just called Intermezzo, and that was kind of where she had established herself. You also see her from For Whom the Bell Tolls, where she was nominated for Best Actress Academy Award. She won Academy Award in Gaslight. She also was nominated for The Bells of St. Mary's, Joan of Arc. Anastasia was her second Academy Award. She also won a Supporting Actress Award for Murder on the Orient Express. And she was also in a TV movie of Haida Gabler, which I thought was interesting. Because we had seen that with...
we had seen it with Cate Blanchett and Hugo Weaving.
Yeah, on Off-Broadway.
Yeah, Brooklyn Academy of Music. Bam!
Yeah, her final film was a 1982 TV movie, A Woman Called Golda. And she won an Emmy for that, but it was after she had passed away.
I'm assuming it's about Golda Meir?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I did not know that.
And of course she is the mother to Isabella Rossellini.
Yes.
And you'd get mad if I didn't say that.
I get mad at everything.
No, that's
awesome, what I
sure.
do. I'm just a big raging monster.
Well, yeah. Okay.
It's okay. Everything's fine.
Talking of, I can't transition from that. we'll just go to Victor Laszlo.
Yes, the biggest monster of the film. The riotous, uppity Victor Laszlo.
He's played by Paul, what is it, Henried?
I'm not telling you.
He considered Bogart a mediocre actor, which I think somebody did point out in the thread.
That's bullshit. I'm going to say it right. I'll just call that out right now. That is garbage.
Really?
Yeah, that's garbage. I'm sorry.
I also read that Bergman called him a prima donna, which I can kind of see.
Yeah, well, that's actors. I mean, he's described every actor ever.
Careful, we have one.
Yeah, there's one here.
And she knows. She knows it. She knows it.
Mr. Henried made his English-speaking debut in 1939 also in a movie called Goodbye, Mr. Chips. Mm. He began being typecasted as Nazi henchman when he was in Mad Men of Europe and Night Train to Munich.
That's where I just recently saw him. I picked that up on Criterion like a couple of months ago. And I was like, I just watched a movie with him in it, and I couldn't remember what it was. And that was it.
There you go. He played opposite of Michelle Morgan, the other actress that was considered for this role, in Joan of Paris. He kind of started his new persona as a debonair, cultured, genteel man in Now Voyager. He was also with Peter Lorre and Claude Rains in Rope of Sand, and he was in Thief of Damascus and Siren of Baghdad. He also directed 28 episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents and Dead Ringer, A Woman's Devotion, and 10 episodes of the Third Man TV series, which I thought was interesting. Moving on to Claude Rains, he is our Captain Renault. We know him from The Invisible Man, The Wolfman, Lawrence of Arabia, The Greatest Story Ever Told. He was in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Notorious. He was also in Now Voyager, The White Tower. He was in a 1943 Phantom of the Opera, where he played a character called Eric Claudine, which is not in the Broadway play, but from what I was reading of the movie, it kind of seemed like they made a different love triangle without the Phantom in there, and then they added the Phantom in. So it was actually quite interesting.
You know what the best Phantom of the Opera movie is? Dark Man.
I've never seen it.
You should see it.
I'm nodding in agreement over here, so yeah.
Yeah, it's just a great movie. Sam Raimi classic, and it is really it is Phantom of the Opera. Like, without the musical, but with, stuffed bunny rabbits. So you should see it. It's really great. Yeah.
Okay.
It's kind of amazing.
Sure. Rains also starred in 5 Alfred Hitchcock Presents movies, and he won Best Supporting Actor Academy Awards for Casablanca, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Mr. Skeffington, and Notorious. Okay, moving on to Major Henrik Strasser. He is played by Conrad Veidt. He was prominent in German silent films. He became a sensation really in 1920 with his role in The Cabinet of Dr. Cagliari.
I always say Cagliari. I must have said Cagliostro 17 times while reading the word on the computer screen. I don't know why. My brain doesn't work on it.
He appeared in Germany's first talking picture, Bridge 68, and one color picture, The Thief of Baghdad. He also fled the Nazis. But then when he was appearing in American films, he was typecasted as a Nazi. He had over 100... I'm sorry, what was that?
I said I hate it when that happens.
Yeah, I'm sure he did too. He had 119 film credits from 1916 to 1943, so he was definitely a prolific actor.
I got to start doing the math on those things. Whenever I find those, I got to just start doing the math on it. Yeah. Was it last week or something? It was... like an average of like 4 point something films a year.
Yeah.
And that like someone directed. Yeah, it was a crazy time. Great.
We're going to go on to Signor Ferrari. He's played by Sidney Greenstreet. He joined a lot of our cast in other films. For instance, he joined Bogart and Peter Lorre in The Maltese Falcon. He was in Christmas in Connecticut, Across the Pacific. He was also in Passage to Marseille with Bogart, Rains, and Lorre. He was in Background to Danger, which also starred George Raft and Peter Lorre. He was in The Conspirators with Hedy Lamarr and Henry and Lorre. He was in The Mask of Demetrios with Peter Lorre, Three Strangers, and The Verdict with Peter Lorre, and Flamingo Road with Joan Crawford. So
Peter Lorre
comes up a lot.
Speak about him, please.
He's only in Casablanca for a little bit, but I think he's quite memorable as Ugarte. We definitely mentioned in the thread that we saw him in the movie M, which I also saw him in, and he was...
Yes, Fritz Lang's M. If you've never seen M, I really think you would enjoy that very much, so seek that out.
Yeah, it was very good. He was also in Crime and Punishment, The Maltese Falcon, The Man Who Knew Too Much. He was in You'll Find Out with Bela Lugosi and Boris Karloff.
What happens in the movie?
You'll find out. He was in Background to Danger with Green Street and Raft. He was in The Mask of Demetrios with Green Street and The Conspirators and The Verdict with Green Street. He was in Arsenic and Old Lace, The Beast with Five Fingers, 20,000 Leagues Under the
it.
Sea.
Thank you. My God. Ryan, you listening to this?
I'm listening. I was waiting. impatiently, but nonetheless.
I took my time on purpose. He was also in another movie called Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, which I thought was interesting.
Wait a minute. Are they remaking that one? Is that the next one that Guillermo del Toro is doing?
I don't know.
I want to say it is. I think he's doing a remake of that, which has been pushed off a couple of months because they want to keep him open for Oscar season due to the buzz that his new film, The Shape of Water, is doing. I'm almost positive that's what he's doing. That or Fantastic Voyage. Not with Coolio. It's different. Okay. It's probably Fantastic Voyage. I'm sorry. Continue.
He was one of the first actors. He was the first actor, I'm sorry.
Ever.
To play Le Chief in a TV movie, Casino Royale, in 1954.
Yeah. Not the same as the other one. No. It's slightly different.
And some of his last films were from Edgar Allan Poe. It was called Tales of Terror with Vincent Price and Basil Rathbone, and The Raven with Boris Karloff and Jack Nicholson. So there's our little...
I've never seen that, and I really need to.
Yeah.
Is Jack Nicholson the Raven? That's all I need to know.
I hope so.
I want Jack Nicholson to be in a Raven costume and just saying nevermore. He's so good.
And finally, I'll talk about Sam, Mr. Julie Wilson. He kind of started out performing in minstrel shows and as a vaudevillian drummer and jazz band leader. He was not a piano player, as seen in the movie, so his piano playing here was dubbed over. It was actually the role was considered possibly for switching it to a female, where they considered Hazel Scott, Lena Horne, and Ella Fitzgerald, which would have been an interesting dynamic. Wilson was also in My Favorite Blonde, Stormy Weather with Lorne, and Passage West, Knock on Any Door with Bogart, and Beulah, which was a TV series. He was in the 1952 to 1953 season, and he was in a movie called Higher and Higher with Michelle Morgan and Frank Sinatra.
Lots of names, classic names that are part of the Casablanca crew. But what is a crew and an actor and director and sets if there is no music to play to it? What do you say towards that, Miss Van Rens, if that really is your name?
I mean, it's the second one I've had, so I guess it's, kind of cheating.
It. May as well.
It's a pretty good one, though.
It's a pretty cool name.
Yeah, I like it.
It's a pretty cool name. I'll take it. CVR.
All right. Good stuff. So our music here is by Max Steiner, who you may remember from The Searchers. He composed our score for The Searchers. I would say that this score is a bit more sparse than what we get in The Searchers. Considering that the two most notable pieces in this, as far as music goes, are As Time Goes By, which was actually written by Herman Hupfeld in 1931 for the musical Everybody's Welcome. And this song is Rick and Ilse's song from when they were in Paris, and it's used throughout the film in many different variations to mirror the action in the film and their relationship and the progression of their relationship. And then the other main song that we have, also not written by Max Steiner, is La Marseillaise, which, if you're unfamiliar, is the French national anthem, which was written in 1792 by Claude-Joseph Roger de Lisle.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. There's a French name for you.
Yeah, it is.
And this piece is used throughout the film to represent the side of the Allies in World War II and the, they not happy about the occupation by the Germans in World War II in French territories, obviously. that scene where Laszlo leads the bar in the singing of La Marseillaise. Yes, we did have people crying on the thread.
Yeah.
And that's an emotional scene because you have many actors in that scene that had fled persecution. And you have people with real tears. Knowing that history about that scene, I don't know how you could really have a dry eye in the house with that one.
Yeah, for sure.
Max Steiner was, as I said, when we discussed him in The Searchers, he is considered the father of film music. He has over 240 composing credits on his IMDb. God. It's insane. He was nominated for 18 Oscars and won 3 in his lifetime for Since You Went Away, Now Voyager, and The Informer. And we've also talked about his other notable scores, King Kong, Gone with the Wind, Arsenic and Old Lace, Cheyenne, The Glass Menagerie. Mm-hmm. This guy's the real thing.
Were film titles just cooler back then?
Yes.
It seems like it.
Isn't there just like, there's like a thing to it. There's just a little bit of extra like panache, you know, put into like every film title. I don't know. It's just different. Like, I don't know if it's just that we say it differently because, you know, it's from a bygone era and there's a little bit of, you know, mystique to it and whatnot, but I just feel like they sounded cooler. Am I crazy, Ryan? I mean, yes, but what about that particular point?
Yeah, besides the fact that you are crazy, it's I do. I think that, you know, nowadays it is either, you know, too long of a title or it's a one-word title. Like, we've been getting into this trap of, like, one-word titles for everything. And yeah. I do. I think there's just a little bit more to some of these old movie names that kind of give you a little bit more to it. And it just kind of – it whether that is what the mystique of it or it is just the fact that somebody took a little bit more time with the title, I don't know. But they do seem to be a little bit cooler.
I mean, does Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales not roll off the tongue for you? Does it not?
Not a dead man's tongue, no. I don't think so.
I like the overseas title for that movie a lot better, Salazar's Revenge. Because...
yeah. Just put that out there. So, like, that's a cooler title.
That sounds cooler. Salazar's Revenge. Like, don't even call it Pirates of the Caribbean. Like, we know it is. We saw the poster. Do you want to talk about the plot? I mean, I have a whole thing for the plot. Chelsea, do you want to talk about the plot? I mean, I got plot notes, but why don't we talk about the plot?
So it's complicated to talk about the whole plot all by myself. So I'm going to need all of you guys to help me out as far as it goes to this, but I'm going to go in an artistic approach and I'm just going to say a theme of the plot and overall. So like we were all saying, you know, that this has gone down in history as one of the most classic films of all time. And I think with good reason, you know, this film, it showed so much in such a theatrical way, which is something that I wanted to point out, you know, that like you were saying, the names, you know, there was so much beauty that went into the entire filmmaking world back in the day. There was so much respect. There was so much dignity that went into this. You know, this is what people escaped from the World War II era to go see these films. So, you know, the actors, the cast, the crew, they had a sense of pride with all these films. You know, so when they were creating it, they knew that they were doing something good. Obviously, they didn't think it was going to be a classic that would be looked at for decades and centuries to come, but they had a sense of pride with it. So with this particular movie, it certainly had a sense of theater, a sense of grandiose, but they wanted to tell a story about what was going on in the world. They wanted to talk about World War II. They didn't want to talk about how it was influencing America and you know, because of course all the movies before were the pride in America, the American, the patriotism.
Yeah.
But this was showing the realistic side of things. What's happening in a world that's not America or in a country that's not America? What people abroad are looking at America like this is where they want to go. This is their, quote, promised land. You know, they're coming to Casablanca. They want to get to America. They want to get to a better future. And this is just pulling an example of pulling back the curtain, showing what it's like in a very theatrical, grandiose, beautiful sense. And then within that, you learn about these characters. You learn about Rick and his story. Of course, you initially see him as the cynical, not given a damn kind of guy. But then you find out he is a human, just like the audience, just like everybody that's going to ever be watching this for the rest of time. He had a lover. He was heartbroken. What led him to be so cynical? Then you see he actually is somebody who wants a better future. You see that he wants to help others. He wants there to be a better future. Ultimately, he notices one of the ever popular themes that happens in theater: love versus duty, love versus honor. And I think that's one of the overarching themes of this movie. You know, love versus honor. You see it in so many characters. You see it in so many scenes of the film. And that's kind of the theme that I wanted to really tackle before we got into the scene by scene.
Yeah. And also what I really love about the character of Rick, very nicely said, is, you know, we never truly know what Rick did. You know, that's always kept in the dark. We have an idea of what Rick did, but we don't know, like, the heavy, heavy specifics. He never clarifies. Other people say things to him, but he never says yes. You know, like, he pretty much does that with everything ever thrown at him in the entire movie, almost.
Yeah.
Like, he never gives a direct yes or no answer. And I think knowing less about his past is better, because then you kind of can build an unsung hero in your head.
It also, like, kind of keeps the whole, like, well, why doesn't he just leave? Like, why doesn't he just go, like, there? Because it's like, well, he can't, but you don't know why. Like,
yeah.
Is it bad enough that he really can't go? Does he really, could he really go, but he's decided to stay because of, you know, the underlying, like, human side of him, that he's just wants to, you know, maybe create a refuge for people? Like, yeah.
I like to think you killed a man. It's romantic in me. This script, yeah, oh man. They, you know, here's a fun little story. So back in the early 80s, people thought it would be fun to do this. They took this script word for word, retitled it to the original play, which was Rick's.
Everybody comes to Rick's.
Everybody comes to Rick's. And sent it out. And it was widely rejected by all the script writers and stuff in the early 80s studios. It was called, you know, too romantic, not enough sex, you know, too corny. The dialogue was terrible. And it was widely, it didn't get past like step one on any of the major studios.
That's hysterical.
Which also proved that all the people who were reading those first drafts, who were the first line of defense on those things to read that, none of them recognized it. A few people recognized it. But, and thought it was, I guess, thought it was amusing. But most people just did not recognize it and discarded it, which I think is fascinating. How you could do that, and people just don't go,
like,
to it.
Even if you don't know all the lines, like, there's some lines that you, like, you know.
I guess not. There's a lot of cocaine being done in the 80s. You can't really hold anyone to anything that they did. It was a wild time. Wild. People were wearing acid wash. There were colors, the things, the music, the, you know what? Everything that everyone did in the 80s just should be forgiven and eliminated from history. So let me give you a quick synopsis of the plot. That's not a real word.
No. You're close.
It's fine. We're just making things up. World War II blazing. Many find themselves fleeing to Casablanca to escape Nazi-controlled Europe. So they flee in hopes to, as Chelsea said, make it to America. America is kind of the finish line for many of these people to find their hope. Cost of a visa, though, is very, very high. And, of course, what do they do, everyone? What does everyone in Casablanca do?
They go to Rick's.
Wait. One way to get out is to have, quote-unquote, letters of transit, things that don't actually exist, but that's what movies are about, so don't worry about it. Two such documents are actually stolen from German couriers, and guess who gets a hold of it? Little guy. It's terrible. But then the local Nazi general Strausser and the prefect of the local police, Louis, we're just going to call him Louis because everyone pretty much calls him Louis, they must search for them. Why? Because there is a man coming to town. His name is Victor Laszlo. He's a resistance leader, an escapee of a concentration camp. And to get possession of one of these would mean that he would be able to leave as well, get on his way, continue his work. And for Strausser, that is no good. And for Louis, he just wants to make Strausser happy. Now, you know, this character doesn't get as much. He makes a quick turn at the end, so he doesn't get the credit. But he makes one of the biggest character spins, you know, in this film, right next to Bogey, you know. Bogey is a little more, we're with him more, so we see it more. But, you know, Louis goes through the same path almost exactly. So, Ugart, I always say his name wrong. Ugarte, or is it just Ugart? I feel like no one ever actually says his name.
Yeah, no, I think they say it with the E at the end.
Yeah, Ugarte? Okay.
Yeah, Ugarte, yeah.
Played by Peter Lorre, offers a deal, because guess what? He's got them. He offers a deal to the proprietor of Rick's, who is Rick, and says, I've got them. You know, can you keep them safe and all that kind of good stuff? Well, later that night, Ugarte is arrested. Rick refuses to help him out, saying one of the many classic lines of the film, I stick my neck out for nobody. And Ugarte is taken away. Is he shot also?
He does come to
yeah.
an unfortunate end.
Unfortunate end. Rick, though, guess what? He's got some letters of transit.
The papers.
Then the door to Rick's opens, and I will say our film starts. Like, this was prologue, and then our film starts. Victor Laszlo enters Rick's. He is not alone. A lovely woman named Ilse Lund is with him, and Laszlo basically starts discussing his current situation with another resistance member. Ilse makes her way over to the piano, almost as if she recognizes somebody. Her and the piano player Sam, who is very shocked to see said Ilse, obviously know each other. And after a moment of a complicated hello, Ilse has a simple request, another line, which is also widely misquoted because of the parody film that Woody Allen made later in life. He says, "Play it, Sam. Play as time goes by." Sam reluctantly agrees to her wish. Rick comes back onto the floor and hears some music. And very calmly almost shats himself. Makes a beeline right over to Sam, saying that he reminded Sam he is never allowed to play that song again. He then looks up, sees Ilse, and is frozen solid. Rick, whom we have been introduced to as a very hard, straight-lined man, is suddenly kind of withered in just an instance of seeing this woman, who he's then introduced to as Victor Laszlo's wife. Fast flash forward that night, Rick is drinking heavily, and we get a large flashback of the time that Ilse and him were in Paris, and they met and they were in love. The war, though, interferes with their future. Ilse, who apparently was wearing blue when the Germans arrived, seems more distraught than anything else because there seems to be something else going on. And she actually abandons Rick at a train station to what she believes will be the time she never sees him again. And Rick is devastated. Now, back to the present time, Ilse needs Rick's help. Word is, everyone knows Rick has these letters of transit. Laszlo needs him to escape the Germans to continue his work. Laszlo asks for help. Rick refuses. Why? Ask your wife. Which is, I never remembered like how harsh that line is. That is a harsh line to throw at somebody. Be like, ask your wife. Like, well, all right, I guess I'll go ask my wife. Before all that, though, before he even gets to go ask his wife, the Germans and Rick's, they start singing, I will not attempt to say it in German. The translation is The Watch on the Rhine. Courtney?
Die Wacht am Rhein.
How did I know that would work?
Well, I did study it.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, in my master's, I had to do all that language study.
Oh, I don't have that in my dossier, if you ever had that. That's crazy. Okay, cool. Well, I know what to do now in the future. Laszlo, though, he's not standing for it. And he goes up to the band and he's like, play, play, damn it. And what is he asked to play? Courtney, you're French, you're foreign.
Oh, La Marseillaise. Right, I'm sorry.
For now on, anything foreign language, you have to say it. I'm not even attempting it anymore in the future. Unless it's Italian, I'm all right with that. The band, though, they don't play a note yet. They look over to Rick. Rick gives the nod and they start playing. The whole crowd joins. Laszlo and the patrons drown out the Germans, and in retaliation, Strasser insists that Louis shut down Rick's, which he is shocked, I say, to discover gambling is happening here. You're winning, sir. Thank you.
You're winnings.
The look that Rick shoots him when he says you're winnings is great.
Yeah.
It's like, are you out of your mind?
Like, don't give him
the
money.
Are you seriously giving this man the money? Like, what are you doing? So later that night, Ilse visits Rick and explains, hey, guess what? A lot of stuff going on here. She was married to Laszlo before they ever met. But then Laszlo was captured, put into a concentration camp. She was thought he was dead. So she was trying to move on. Well, during the time that she met and when the Germans started coming in, she learned he's not dead, but he's hurt badly. She felt the pull to go back to him, to take care of him, to help him get him back to, health. She didn't know how to tell Rick, and, she left. Here's the bigger problem, though. She still kind of loves Rick, and Rick obviously loves her. So now what do you do? Now they're all conflicted. And she can't come to a decision because she's a woman in a 1940s film. And she says, you know, Rick, you pretty much decide for us. That's right, right? I mean, it's kind of, I don't know. They make her a really strong character, but they take like the biggest decision of the movie for her out of her hands.
Yeah. I definitely had that in my notes.
But
yeah, it was the one thing about her that pissed me off.
Yeah, but she's got a lot going on, though. She has a lot going on. I mean, there's a lot of things flying, and I like that Rick reads it exactly. He reads that situation correctly. So Laszlo, during this, when they're, you know, Rick and Elsa are having their little meetup, he's at a resistance meeting that is broken up by the Germans and the police. He escapes to Rick's because that's the one – all roads lead to Rick's. And he asks Rick for help, kind of in a – it's not a mirror of the scene with Ugadi because he's not as desperate and as slimy as a character. But it is sort of, a revisit of that theme of someone asking Rick for help. And we've seen Rick sort of start to help the lesser folk in the film at this moment. So he requests that, hey, don't worry about me, but take the papers that I know you have. Everyone knows you have. Get Elsa out of Casablanca. So now Rick has not only Elsa saying, you know, what should we do? Should we just leave? And now he's got Laszlo telling him, you and Elsa should leave. The police enter, they arrest Laszlo, and he's taken away. The next day, Rick, he goes to visit Louis, and he proposes a little bit of a plan. He says, you know what? You picked up Laszlo on a garbage charge. It's not going to get you any glory. What if we get this up a little bit? Surprise, surprise, I do have the papers. Where were they? The piano. Unfortunately, Louis's not a music lover, so he missed out on that. He explains to him that, hey, I have the papers. I'll give them to Laszlo. You can arrest him then. You'll be cheered. You'll look great for Strausser, and everything will look fine. Louis, though, you know, he doesn't think that Rick is the angel of Earth, but he doesn't think that this is very Rick-like either. So why are you doing this for? And Rick explains, it's for the girl. And for Louis, that's more than enough. That's all he needs to hear because that's all that he sees things in sometimes. But Rick is setting up a deck. As Louis attempts to arrest Laszlo with the papers in hand, Rick pulls a gun on him and says that Laszlo and Ilsa are now going to board this plane and get out of here. Now. Not later, not any, just right now. They're going to get going. He then gives one of the greatest on-screen speeches of all time. And with tears in her eyes, Ilsa agrees that she will leave with Laszlo. Strausser arrives to arrest everyone, pretty much. But Rick just shoots him, because that's what you do with Nazis. Shoot him. I don't think anyone can argue with that one.
Nope.
But I'm sure someone will. Louis then suddenly sees the light. He covers for Rick, suggests that we just round up the usual suspects to find out who actually shot Major Strausser. And Rick and Louis are back in the fight. And to everyone who sees that scene, you might say this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. That is a very coarse, very quick rehash of the plot of Casablanca. A couple of just fun little trivia notes. The piano that Sam plays, the one that he plays in Paris was auctioned off in 1988 for $154,000. The one that he plays at Rick's Cafe was auctioned off for $600,000.
Wow.
I don't know why. In my head, that's a $1 million thing. But I also don't know exactly the year that was sold. And it may have, inflation may have made that number a little larger now. Mm-hmm. Rick's was one of the cafe was one of the few original sets that were built for the film. The rest were all recycled from Warner Brothers' other productions. And it was actually modeled after the Hotel Esminza in Tangiers, Morocco.
Yeah, yes. I like the flyover in the beginning. Like, you get to see a lot of the buildings where, if you're familiar with Epcot, it's definitely...
Yeah, it does. It does look like the Morocco. That's right. The final scene, a classic final scene, plane in the background... not a real plane. It was actually constructed of plywood and balsa, not Elsa, but balsa, by the locals. And little people were put in jumpsuits to make it all look larger than it actually was. And this is a direct sort of connection to a film we recently watched, Alien, where the same technique was used to make the spaceship look bigger. And Melissa?
Did you know that even though it was a model, like not a model, but like a fake plane, that Disney actually purchased a real plane for the Great Movie Ride?
Yeah, because that's what you do.
Because that's what you do in Disney.
One up them.
You cut it in half and you put half of it in one ride and half of it in another.
Yeah, actually, yeah, that's right. The film has 6 quotes on the AFI list of top movie quotes. Yes?
That's it?
6 out of 100. I mean, you can't put the whole script. I mean, yes, you could.
I mean.
It's just like entry number one, the script. In it, 67 was of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world, she walks into mine. 43 is We'll Always Have Paris. Number 32 was Round of the Usual Suspects. 28 was Play It, Sam, Play As Time Goes By. 20 was Louis, I Think This Is the Beginning of a Beautiful Friendship. Number 5, His Look at You, Kid. Number 1, Gone with the Wind. Eh, fine. I don't know.
Which would the one, the...
Is it a...
Frankly...
Yeah, Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. Yeah, that one. That's what wins. I don't know. Yeah.
What? Yeah, for what?
For number 1? Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know. I'd have to revisit the movie. I've only watched it once. I think it was on VHS also.
I feel like there's something in Wizard of Oz that would, like, be the number 1. Like
Follow the Yellow Brick Road or...
The Kansas line. I don't think we're in Kansas anymore.
Yeah. I wonder if that's number 2. It actually might be number 2. I should look at that list.
We'll discuss next week. Don't worry.
We'll talk about that next week. And then just one final note, and then we're just going to... with the death of Madeleine LeBeau on May 1st, 2016, there are no surviving members of the credited cast anymore with us on Earth. But where are they? In Casablanca.
On Earth, too?
Waiting.
Where are you waiting?
Waiting.
I'm waiting. So let's get into this film from a standpoint of discussing the film itself. That may have been the most pre-notes we've ever done. But there's just so much to talk about in this film that most people are so familiar with it. Like, you know, the discussion of the film itself is something, you know, I thought it was fun to try to get into the background of it a little more on this particular episode. Ryan Wilson, I know you're feeling under the weather, so I haven't wanted to go to you so much. I feel so bad, but...
It's okay. Every time I try to cough, I mute myself, so I'm not, you know...
Yeah, I feel bad because I know you're not feeling great, so I don't want to go to you, but I also want your voice on this show so much. you know, Todd, you know, tell me about Casablanca. What is it about Casablanca you think that's made it work as long as it has and continue to create fans where there are eras of the 40s and the 30s? You know, some of those films, you try to sit down people in front of it and it just doesn't click with them for whatever reason. It doesn't click with a modern audience. But this one has an absolute timelessness to it. Why do you think it has such that effect on folks?
You know, I've been thinking about this a lot this week, and I think about our generation and what makes this click to our generation. And this is going to sound like an odd, real wraparound kind of way, but I think it does two things that kids of the 80s grew up with in film that we love really, that we loved a whole lot. You have kind of this Rick-ish, like this Han Solo indie kind of roguish character. You also have this great romance a la like Pretty in Pink and all of those kinds of movies. And it's almost like the meshing of those two things. Like you get these two just great themes of, you know, the roguish guy who's going to do the right thing in the end. And this just love story that's just, you know, dripping with angst and with, you know, you don't know who's going to end up with who, but you're kind of okay with no matter how this shakes out. And it just resonates with people, and you get that, you know, and I'm a hopeless romantic. I always have been a hopeless romantic. And so this just brings together so much of what I love in movies from, you know, there's not a ton of action. It's really more story driven from minute one. And it's just really, really incredible the way it weaves through the story.
It has a flow to it. It has a flow to it, a modern flow to it in a classic film. The pacing is fast. It's fast, but it's not rushed. Always a hard balance to try to find. And, yes. You know, Chelsea, as you were talking before, the themes, you know, from the film back then are effective now. And I think it has to do also with just characters that are likable and interesting.
Yes. Yeah. They're so, the characters, they have so many layers to them, which is something that's, again, so theatrical, and it's so attractive to audiences because it's something that audiences can connect to. We can connect to Rick at certain times. We can connect to Ilsa at certain times. You know, I was trying to, as I was thinking about this film all week, I was, like Ryan, I was trying to think of what it is that makes this such a classic timelessness. And even with the conflict that Ilsa has, I was trying to think, what would I do if I was in that situation? And I couldn't think, what would I do if the person that I loved, I thought was dead, so I moved on and I fell in love again? Well, I couldn't wrap my head around it. So that, again, is another conflict that certainly you can identify with, and you can identify with the angst and the conflict that you have. And I think at the end of the day, it's a piece of art in so many ways, visually, sound, all of your senses are stimulated with this movie in such an artistic way. It really is like a dance, you know, going back to the direction. You know, the camera movements are done like you are there in the room. You are moving with the camera. The movements are so fluid. It really truly is like a dance. The sense of shadows, which is another Curtis-ism. You know, the sense of shadows. You see it in that one scene. You see Rick getting something out of his cabinet, or in the vault, rather, and just the sense of shadows. And you see the blinds coming over Ilsa in the scene in the top with Rick. And it just, all of the hidden meanings in that, the use of shadows, the use of movement, it's beautiful. And it really is a work of art, and a work of genres, I think, is another thing I want to point out too. The mix of genres in this film, it's a romance, certainly. It's also a gangster mobster movie.
Yeah.
It's also a melodrama. You can, it's just so timeless, and it's such a classic, and it's all done so beautifully.
Yeah. It's like part noir, part mystery, part romance, part thriller. It's its own little sort of thing. And Courtney, I remember you pointed out the shadows as being, you know, something that was striking to you when we were watching it.
Yeah, absolutely. There were things on the first watch that I didn't even realize were happening. When Rick's sitting there in the cafe waiting for Ilsa, at that first scene, and you have the shadows on the wall, and then you have the light that's coming by, and I couldn't figure out. On the first watch, I was like, wait, what is that? And then when I watched it again yesterday, I was like, oh, there's a spotlight outside. Yeah. And they're using that inside the room, creating this effect. It's just that, yeah, the shadows are amazing. The use of light, all the cinematography, it's just incredible.
and just another example off of that I was just thinking of when you were talking about the shadows with the scene, even that scene with Rick when he's at his club just waiting, you see that there's like just such a juxtaposition of the light on his face and then the darkness. Right. Symbolizing the conflict that he's having, you know, the difference between what he used to be and what he is. And even with Laszlo, there always seems to be light on him. They're always, even so much as it seems like they specifically put a light on his face.
Yeah.
Completely different than the soft focus on Ilsa or the complete contrast on Rick. And it's just, it's completely done intentionally. And it leaves the audience so much to think about.
But it's also that's the stuff that is subconscious to the audience 99% of the time. Yeah. Like you don't notice that's happening. Spielberg did that in Lincoln. Daniel Day-Lewis's face is rarely, if ever, fully illuminated. There's only a couple of scenes where that happens because Spielberg wanted to keep the idea and the man of Lincoln in mystery. Like, actually, and speaking of use of shadows and use of spotlights and this and that and people being drowned in darkness and then having a little bit of light put on them, you know, me and Melissa watched, it was my second trip into it. We watched Blade Runner yesterday. And everything that we just heard from, you know, from Chelsea and Courtney, they do that in Blade Runner.
Yeah. And I thought it was interesting because, like, as we were talking about the shadows in Casablanca, like, I was like, well, how would this look if it was in color? Because I feel like so much of Casablanca is, it's so perfect in its black and whiteness, and it makes the shadows even that much more stark because it is just so literal black and white sometimes. You know, it's so dark versus so light, especially with, like, the spotlight versus the darkness, you know. So, like, but then, like, you know, thinking about it, how would they do it in Blade Runner, it's not necessarily that it's the color ruins it, but it's like then the use of color just like it changes it just enough.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, the encapsulating Casablanca with black and white, I don't think you should ever try and like.
There is a colorized version, just in case anyone never wants to look it up. Yeah, no. There is a colorized version. It's terrible.
It's like when I watched Logan
Noir. It just steals
Noir.
His soul. Yes.
And then, like, yeah. I was on a plane and I saw somebody watching it in color, and it just looked like a regular movie, and it just took it away.
I will never forgive two of our friends. We had two friends come over to watch Logan, because as you know, Logan was, you know, the Wolverine film, shot in color, but really the director always wanted it in black and white. So they put out a noir version in black and white, and it's gorgeous. It just makes the movie work so much more. And I had two friends who insisted on watching the color version. I was like, well, you're dead to me.
But even speaking to the light in the movie, it actually goes to character arcs. If you look at Rick when you're in Paris and he's happy, he's actually much better illuminated. There's much more clarity on his face. There's not that contrast happening. You know, it goes to that level of, yes, we have it for characters, but it's also into what part of where we are with this character as to how we're going to portray that.
Yeah, and I feel like that's maybe why Laszlo doesn't necessarily get the shadows so much, because like his character is never really conflicted. Like, he has a mission, he knows what he's doing, like, this is his goal. Like, he's always the one that kind of has that, whereas Rick and Ilsa, they always have that conflict after Paris of, you know, whether it's Ilsa's, do I stay with my husband or do I go with this new person I fell in love with? Do I stick with the cause? Do I, you know, follow my heart? And of course, Rick's conflict is not only with Ilsa, but, you know, do I fight? Do I just become this hardened person who doesn't care about anybody else because caring got me hurt in the first place? Like,
yes. So. That is the accurate answer, by the way, everyone. Rick had it right the first time.
You're terrible.
Meh.
Stick your neck out for nobody.
I stick my neck out for nobody. I love that. I wanted that on a shirt so badly. Oh, my goodness. Let's talk about that.
I'm sure it's out there.
I'm sure it's out there, yeah. Let's talk about this script. This script is just packed with memorable dialogue, snappy dialogue, clever, heartfelt. It just hits all the right buttons. I don't think it's aged one bit. There's nothing – like, we've watched a lot of older films, and there's usually something that happens, and you're like, whoa, well, oh, yep, that was a thing that was said then and shouldn't be said anymore, maybe? I don't think Casablanca has a single moment like that. I don't even think that there's a corny line of dialogue in the film. Nothing sits oddly with me from zero to the finish. It just doesn't. You know, Courtney, again, like going towards the thread that we had on Wednesday. How much of it was just people writing the dialogue before it happened?
A lot, and a lot of GIFs of people, like, same thing. It was just, like, pop-up of, like, this is about to happen. Here's a GIF of it.
Yeah.
Here you go.
It's crazy that it's just that tightly wound and that sharply done that, you know, people just know it. They just know it. Even if you don't know the movie, as Melissa was saying, you know, even if you don't know the movie, you know it. You know something about it. You might be quoting it incorrectly, you know. that's a thing that happens. But that's, you know, what happens when a great parody comes out. And yeah, it was there were two parodies of this film in particular. There was the Woody Allen parody, and there was something else, but I honestly can't remember the name of it. Not that it's very important right now. So I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what else to really say towards the film. In the sense of what it brings, because it brings so much. Here's a question I always like throwing at people. And Court and Chelsea, you leaned on it before. You don't know what you would do if you were Ilsa in the situation. And I have heard people give the character of Ilsa some flack because she doesn't make that choice on her own. So now I put it to you, oh giver of flacks. That's a thing. So, Ryan, if you were Ilsa, well, things would be different.
That's a different movie entirely.
I want to see it, though.
I'm sure there are a few. Oh, I'm sure that would do well. I'm not, you know.
What would you? Where do you? Where do you go? Do you go with Rick? Do you stay with? You go with Laszlo? Where are you going?
You go with Laszlo. I think that is. I think you made your decision in Paris when you went back to him. I think that that is your first, you know, your first true love. And if you're so you don't know where Rick's going. You don't know what his, you know, truly where his life is going to go. And, you know, especially since you haven't been honest with Victor, I don't know. I think the right choice was made for her, but I think that was the choice to be made.
Melissa?
Yeah, I kind of think Ryan hit it when he said she made her choice in Paris. Like, if you were going to stay with Rick, you would have stayed with him then, you know, maybe even just check to see if Laszlo really was alive. But then if you really, like, wanted to move on, you should have then. Like, it's been years since she saw Rick. I think she kind of, in her heart, while she might still have the feelings for him, they might not be as hot as they once were. So I think she knew what she had to do, but to actually make that decision, she didn't want to. So mm-hmm. Rick helped her out, and like you said, like Rick read that situation. Like Rick knew, like, you know, he was not number one in her life, and especially, like, I don't think he ever would have been, just because there was somebody before him. But now that that person is still around, like, he knew he could never hold her heart like he had.
Courtney?
Yeah, I think that Laszlo is the correct decision too. And I think that's, I mean, aside from the fact that she married him and went back to him, if she's making someone else make the decision, if she's asking Rick to make the decision, obviously she's not confident enough about being with Rick to stay with Rick. Mm-hmm. So she, I think staying with Laszlo is the correct decision in this case for sure.
Are you telling me that if she doesn't get on that plane, she'll regret it?
They'll always be a part of her.
Maybe not today. Maybe not tomorrow.
Maybe not today. Maybe not tomorrow. But they'll always be a part of her.
I agree. I think she goes the right way. I think that, yeah, eventually guilt would wreck her for leaving Laszlo, especially because leaving Laszlo kind of means like leading him to his death. Mm-hmm. I'd be more interested in seeing that decision if she's just at a crossroads where like Nazis aren't on the end of one road and like just both roads are like picket fence, you know? You can go with whichever one. I think in that case, she goes with Rick. Ha! But under the situation, you got to go with Laszlo. You can't leave a man to die at a concentration camp. You just can't do it. Paris was nice. Well, it's not that nice. Jesus. All right, just the final little thing on here. Does anyone want to say anything else towards that before we get into our questions?
Well, I do want to talk a little bit just about Ilsa.
All right.
Because this is postcode, and I know like when we were
postcode,
we watched Footlight Parade, and you know, we talked about how like the strong women characters were a thing that were seen pre-code, and then postcode it kind of got nixed a bit because, you know, heaven forbid a woman be strong.
Yep.
So I like how, even though like they made that decision for her, everything else in her like character is very strong. Like, she's able to deliver a tearful, emotional line without seeming like a weepy, weak girl. Like, you know.
Oh, maybe sort of like, I don't know, Jane from last week's Tarzan?
Yeah.
Like, that would be a good example of that, you know? Could you imagine if that was how, like, oh my God, if she was screaming the whole time in your ear, like in the middle of Casablanca, oh man, shut this woman up. No, but you're 100%, yeah.
So I thought that was really nice that we actually get like a postcode strong woman who's able to be emotional as anybody would be in that situation. You know, she is destroyed inside and out, but she's able to pull herself together, hold it together, and make, you know, most decisions. Like, she's able to go to Rick and be like, I need these papers. You know,
she points a gun at him.
Yeah, she's, even though, you know, she doesn't pull the trigger, but like, yeah, she's like able to.
She still brought a gun with her. Like, this is pretty, you know, it's pretty good.
She wants those papers.
So if we were to make a shirt that said pre-code or post-code, which one would you want? It's just pre-code, big letters.
I mean, I'm all for strong women, so.
But there's a lot of the strong women have come post-code.
Yeah.
But you go pre-code.
I mean.
You pre-code animal, you. Animale. Chelsea, I think you also had something you wanted to say.
Yeah, I was just going to say that it really does harken back. I know I said it kind of before, but it, the whole conflict does harken back to love versus honor. You know, what should you ultimately go with? What your heart wants or what your duty is? What your duty is as a wife, what your duty is as a refugee wanting to escape, what your duty is to your personal dreams and your own personal goals, you know, and but at the same time, you know, I think you did fall in love with Rick. I think that's somebody that you did care for and somebody that you will always care for, you know. But your duty is to your husband, your duty is to your country and your patriotism and to your goal towards finding a better life. And that is what you need to go to at this time. And it just, again, harkens back to love versus honor, but also the time, you know, kind of identifying with what probably so many people had to deal with back in that time that we maybe can never know completely what they went through. But this is just a pullback of the curtain, audience view of it.
If you were ever curious of what would happen with the future of the characters of Casablanca, just as a final note, there was in 1943 in Hollywood Reporter, there was a reported sequel being put together for this film called, unfortunately, Brazzaville, which is a terrible name. Like, that's a really bad name.
Weren't we just talking about how the names back then were really good?
Yeah, this was.
That's why it never got off the ground. That's why.
But Bogey was set to reprise, and Geraldine Fitzgerald and Sydney Greenstreet were also going to be co-starring. But you can also just read a 1998 novel entitled As Time Goes By, which was written by Michael Walsh for Warner Books. And the novel follows the characters of Rick, Ilsa, Victor, Sam, and Louis post-Casablanca, when they all leave Casablanca. So... Three questions have the...
What?
Yes. What are they? Melissa?
We're going to see what the iconic shot is. We're going to ask if it is an immoral film or an emotional film. And does it succeed? And we'll find out if it still holds up.
It does. Let's argue about the other things first, though. Chelsea, you know what? You've been quite elegant in speaking towards the possible themes and morals of the film. So what do you feel towards, does this film have a moral aim? Does it achieve it?
Yes. And yes, I know. But again, I'm going to reiterate all the notes that I made before, but also... It does show the human capacity for love, for loss, for redemption, you know, for idealism, realism, cynicism, humor, you know, and all of these emotions that are happening in World War II era, you know, in a country that is so different from us, but people that are so much like us. So it certainly is. And at the same time, though, it is emotional. There are romance elements. There are elements to the characters that everybody can identify with. So it's a mixed bag. I probably wouldn't be able to say one or the other. But
well, I agree with you. I think that it does have a moral. It has themes. It has morals. If only just from like patriotic, you know, sort of point of view stuff. And I think it nails it. If it didn't nail it, there wouldn't be people watching it in 2017 crying whilst watching the scene of Marseille. I'm sure I said that wrong. So Courtney, how are you? How are you? By the way, I also want to make sure this is a cynicism. You would try it, but you probably wouldn't like it. Anyways, Courtney, what do you think about themes? Does it achieve?
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think we have a mixed bag. Obviously, there's the, you know, the patriotic side of things and, you know, the war themes. That's highly, highly present. And, you know, you have your P.S. Nazis are bad again, which we've seen a whole lot recently. So, yeah, that's our big moral. And then, you know, all of the internal struggles, like Chelsea's been talking about, all of that, I think, plays to the overarching emotional aspect of the film. I think if your heartstrings aren't tugged at and if you're not conflicted while watching this movie, you might be some sort of psychopath.
Or a replicant.
Possible.
Melissa?
My first instinct was to go with the emotional part of it. I mean, yeah, there's morals and themes. I feel like if you then step back and analyze it, yeah, you get all of them. But for me, like, it first jumped out as it was an emotional film. Like, there's just so much raw emotion throughout that. That's where I landed with that.
And you feel it succeeds?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Because especially with everyone's reaction. I mean, if you don't tear up when Ilsa tears up and making her decision, or even when she pulls the gun on Rick, you know, there's the gasp, like, oh no, is she going to do it? Like, you get very invested.
That last scene gets me. Yeah. It always gets me. It got me on Great Movie Ride. I would cry on Great Movie Ride. Ryan Wilson, Main Street Gazette. Where do you lie on this argument?
This movie makes me feel nothing. No, it absolutely achieves its goal, but I think it's hand in hand. I think it's, you have the emotions drive your morals drive your emotions. You know, you get things in this, you know, we've talked about honor. We've talked about duty. We've talked about, you know, how you treat your fellow man, even down to the point where Ferrari is asking, you know, how much you want, you know, what do you want for Sam? And he's like, I don't deal in, you know, I don't trade in people. Mm-hmm. You have all of these pieces that come in. You know, you have these great conflicted love stories. You have this sense of, you know, brotherhood amongst Louis and Sam and Rick. And you have all of it, and it all succeeds on every level when you see it. So yeah, it's both, and it succeeds impeccably.
Let's then move on to iconic shot. Iconic shot. Once again, to reiterate the rules that I feel I must reiterate every week, for one person in particular, a shot is a single frame of film, not a scene, not a movement, not a moment. Well, I guess it is a moment. It's a frame. 1/24th. Was it 1/24th of a second? It's 24 of them every second. You gotta pick one of them. Melissa, what is your shot of the movie? Unbelievable.
Well, I have a runner-up that I must mention.
It's like chewing glass.
Because I like the scene of them in Paris when Sam's playing and Rick and Ilsa are behind him, and they're just like, it's just like a nice little triangle, and it looks very, very nice. My shot is,
yes,
when...
Yes! Dramatic pauses.
I know. It's Rick and Ilsa at the end with the "he's looking at you, kid" moment.
When he's looking at her, so it's a two shot. She's to the back to the camera, and you can see him looking at her.
No. When he's saying, yeah, well, I guess when he's saying,
okay,
yeah, when he's saying that line.
That is an accurate pick. Just looking at you because I don't trust you. Yeah. Waiting for you to say something to follow it up. And the next 87 seconds. I thought this
was, well,
like,
I thought you were
going to
get mad at me because I was like, when he's saying that line, which is more than...
I'll just freeze frame it in my head. It's fine. It's okay. You know, that's quite good. Quite good. Quite good. Ryan, how about you?
You know, I want it to be one of the romantic moments, but it's not. The shot I always come back to is Louis and Rick halfway down. You can see the lights on the runway. The fog is rolled in, and it's the, you know, it's sort of a beautiful friendship, that moment right there.
That is a hell of a shot, too. That's a hell of a shot, too. CVR?
I'm going to go with the gin joints shot. I love all the shadow behind him in that shot. I love that half of his face is in shadow, half in light. The look on his face when he finishes saying that line, that he just has this, like, dejected, like, I mean, that's the shot to me. And that's the line to me, too. I love all that.
Great. Chelsea?
Yeah, and he's in such despair. It's yeah, amazing. So my shot is when Sam plays as time goes by. And Ilsa just, the moment where she looks down but then looks off to the side. So I guess the frame when she looks off to the side, and it just... You immediately know that she is thinking about Paris. She is thinking about Rick. The soft focus. Her eyes are glistening as she's looking down and going back. That's the moment that just resonates with me, and it's stuck with me every time I see it.
For me, it's actually it's the plane. It takes place during the plane sequence. It is the two shot of them. It's just, that's mine. Just freeze frame that. Man, this movie's good, though. This is the one movie where, like, if we just wanted to say the whole damn thing, I'd have been like, all right.
Oh, sure. Now we get that.
I only say it after you said your thing. The last question is just silly to even go around the table. With a yes or no answer on the count of three, as in 1, 2, 3, answer, we are all going to say whether or not we feel this film holds up. So give your answer, as I said, on the after the three. So 1, 2, 3,
yes.
Yes. All right. We're all in agreement. I don't have to kill anyone. That's good. This movie just works. It works. Just start to finish. I do honestly feel like there are some films that they sit in an area of, you know, the realm of film where, like, if you can't watch it and enjoy it, then you just don't get it. Like, the whole thing, like, the whole purpose of film. This is one of them. If you can't sit down and not look at your phone and not have a conversation with other people, if you can't sit down and enjoy this thing, you're missing the point of just the medium as a whole. This is one of those movies. So, I can't say enough about my adoration for this film, you know.
Yeah, no, it's timeless. It's as timeless as we talked about with Indiana Jones.
Yeah, I think Indiana Jones, I think Raiders of the Lost Ark is in that conversation too, actually. I really do. I think that's how damn fine that film is also. Courtney, any last thoughts you want to say towards Casablanca and everyone at Rick's?
I just think that I think it's exceptional. I think the acting, I think the cinematography, I think the story, I think the dialogue, I think all of it is just, it's so good, holds up amazingly well. I would, again, recommend this to anybody, and I will watch it for the foreseeable future.
Ryan?
Yeah, there's not a scene in this film, excuse me, that you couldn't just pull out in isolation and show people and say, this is what filmmaking is about. It's that good from start to finish. Everything clicks the entire time. It's timeless. It's, you know, almost, you know, as close to a perfect movie as you're ever going to see.
Courtney, any last words towards this film?
I think you meant Chelsea.
Yes, I did. I apologize. Too many C's.
I know.
It's okay. Yeah, I just to piggyback off of everybody, this movie is the culmination of everything that a film should be. You know, beauty, the theme, the cinematography, the camera, just every aspect of this filmmaking process is a classic. It's class act. It's a masterpiece, really. And there's some films that you hear of, that you know of, that you've seen a million times. And of course, everybody says it's one of the greatest films of all time. You're like, yeah, but this film, there's a reason for it. This film, there's a reason why it is in the history books as being one of the best films of all time.
Yeah.
And it's just, of course, one of my favorites for many, many personal reasons, but it's something that I look to as an artist for inspiration, for, you know, when I'm studying film, when I'm studying acting, these actors had to give it their all, and they did. The screenwriters had to give it their all, and they did. The director certainly gave it his all, and it's an inspiration to me as an actor, and it should be inspirations to all audiences for so many reasons, for all time.
Were you referring to Citizen Kane?
How'd you know?
Were you?
How'd you know?
Because everyone does that. Everyone. I don't know why. I like that movie, but yeah, it's almost as if it's like it's spoken of so much that it's the positivity behind that film has made it a negative in the long run. Because it's a cold film, you know. It's overall a pretty cold film. That's a whole conversation, though. But yeah, Citizen Kane is always the movie that, when, you know, it's one of those things that people are like, it's the greatest, and I understand why it is because of everything that it did that new movies did before it,
yes.
And that movies like Casablanca take note of, and then, you know, do the on their own terms. But. It isn't as popular as a film. It's nowhere near as popular as a film, as beloved as a film. It's always an odd little thing. So, all right, guys. Well, hey, man, we're almost done. We got one more. We got one more film in the Great Movie Ride canon that we are going to discuss, and that is a Wizard of Oz. That's next week. And then, you know, we're going to do other stuff because there's going to be another show that has to be recorded. Thank you so much for joining us this week. This was a blast. And we have one thing that we have to do before we say goodbye. Time to pick this week's winner of Giving Away KJ. Of course, this is the portion of the show that ye gets rewarded for liking and sharing the pinned post over at Disney at the Last Gen podcast Facebook page. And our winner this week is for liking, sharing. Sorry, apologize. For liking and sharing the pinned post on the Last Gen podcast Facebook page, which is always going to be the most recent episode of Disney Magic Hour. And something else coming up soon. But this week's winner, without further ado, is Boone Gilligan Johnson. Congratulations, sir. We recently spoke, too, so that's awesome. So congratulations, mate. PM me. Let me know your address so I can mail you out your KJ lithograph. Of course, art done by Disney master artist Kevin John. Go over to kevinjohnstudio.com. Check out all that he has available and follow him on Facebook. Right now, he is putting together a new piece for Disney of the castle, and it is absolutely breathtaking.
Yeah.
It is so phenomenal. So congratulations. Thank you to all who entered and all who support this show on a weekly basis. You are the ones that keep it going. Huge love and thanks to all the Patreon members, our production assistants, who are there with us every week as we watch films and chat along during them in the silent realm of Facebook commentating, or as it's known in our group, basically just finding GIFs. I mean, if you can't say what you got to say in a GIF form, then is it really worth saying?
Yes.
It probably is. but try to find a GIF. I mean, just attempt. It's always worth it. So,
especially if it includes a dog slapping a man.
Oh my god, that thing!
That killed you.
I lost 5 solid minutes of the movie because I just kept watching that thing and laughing. I think of it right now. That dog with his eyes dart over, smashes that dude in the face. That is so great. It's such a great thing. Look up. Dog slap man GIF. It'll probably come up. I don't know if that's going to work, but it probably will. It's the best. It is the best. Thank you, everyone, for joining us this morning. I want to thank our special guest, Chelsea Lucas. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
I know you're very busy right now with the move and work and all that, so I appreciate you taking time out of your Sunday morning, to join us. And thanks to Gwen Stefani for that song. Because that's what's really bringing it all together, is Gwen Stefani. Is she aged yet?
She ain't no Hollaback girl.
She aged? She's drinking unicorn blood? What is that woman doing?
It's definitely unicorn blood.
It's really weird. It's really crazy. I think she's just darkness from Legend. We don't know it yet. All right, guys.
Again with the unicorns.
Unicorns all week, all day. Why, did I say unicorns before?
Yeah, you said drinking unicorn blood, and then the unicorn in Legend, and Blade Runner has a unicorn. All the unicorns.
Oh my god, I can't wait to talk about Blade Runner, and then not really talk about the plot that much because you don't want to know it before you go in. Till next week, folks. Thank you so much for tuning in. This episode, guess what? It was brought to you by DM. It was not brought to you by DMH. This episode of Disney Magic Hour, though, was brought to you by MEI Travel. There's a lot of things with initials on my worksheet. For all your vacation planning needs, visiting Walt Disney World, taking a cruise, traveling anywhere around the globe, visit the experts over at meitravel.com. Becky and her team can get you started on your own adventure, and we are very excited because I believe in about a month's time or so, Becky's going to be appearing on this show here. Yes. Ooh. And there's going to be a bracket. I'm not going to tell you what it is. But there will be knives. I will guarantee that. There's probably going to be some knives. So right now you're listening to There You Are. You can find this track and more over at soundcloud.com/pogomix. His website is pogomix.net. We are lastgenpodcast.com. Who would have known? You can find this show on Twitter at Diz Magic Hour Pod. That's D-I-S Magic Hour Pod. On Facebook, we are Disney Magic Hour. Search for us. Add yourself to the group. And as long as you're not selling sunglasses, everything should be fine. And then you can add your friends, and yeehaw, we'll have fun. You can find this show over at iTunes, Google Play Music, and Stitcher. Melissa, tell people about a couple of things.
All right, on Instagram, you can find us at Disney Magic Hour Podcast. And on Patreon, you can find how you can support us, patreon.com/DisneyMagicHour, and help keep us going.
And I want all the Patreon members to know that due to your support and your love, our sweet Ryan Wilson will be receiving a brand new microphone.
Yay!
Nice!
Yeah, in a couple of weeks. But yeah, he'll be getting a brand new microphone, and that's all due to you. Because I don't have any money. Right? Deal with it.
Me either.
Yes. None of us do. Till next week, say goodnight, Melissa.
Goodnight, Melissa.
Say goodnight, Courtney.
Goodnight, Courtney.
Say goodnight, Ryan.
Good night, Ryan.
Say good night, Chelsea.
Good night, Chelsea.
Good night, Pogo. Nope. Ah, ruined that, huh? Good night, Pete. Say good night, Pogo.